Hello and welcome to Shelf Perspective, book podcast focused on both craft and chaos of fiction. I'm Knox McCoy. Joining me as always, not two of the highest paid podcasters in the world, is Jimmy Golden and Aaron Moon. Did you see those salaries?
I did, and I thought, okay, two-thirds of these are grifters.
Wait, I haven't seen this.
They're grifting.
Aaron, but you gotta look up these salaries. People are making like $19 million a year podcasting.
Kudos to Giggly Squad, which I enjoy, Hannah and Paige, who lay in bed to record their podcast, circa Aaron, when we had a 9-episode podcast called Golden Moon Buffet. And I love that they give $18 million. $18 million! And they're the lowest paid on the list.
That's crazy.
It's absurd.
What I would do to get paid $18 million a year.
And Amy Poehler's not getting paid enough. I'll tell you that right now. She's not getting paid enough either.
I agree with you. Also, it's a low lift, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like... But hey, get your money. I don't
get your money. But I would like to compare this to the highest downloaded podcast, because I bet these lists are not the same. You know,
that is 100% true. That is 100% true.
So we're not making. So just in case anyone was wondering, we're not splitting $18 million. No. We didn't just miss the list either.
Yeah. So. Yet.
Knox is always confident.
With your help, we can. Maybe next year we crack that list, guys. Let's crack the list.
Our powers combined.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. In this episode, we are going to be talking about the school curriculum classics that we think should stay in school reading list and the ones that should go.
But before we do that, you may have noticed this is a free episode, which we also had last week with our Emily Henry author deep dive. So we swapped up this rhythm because it's back to school season and we wanted to do a special duology episode, which you're already in. Okay. You did it. Part one. Okay. And next week's part two. It will be only for our hardbacks community because we are trying to get on that list. And so, but as a treat, if you use code Animal Farm, you can get 2 months free. But that is limited to the first 100 folks who click the link in the show notes. Okay. So if you're a freebie right now and you're like, what's a hardback life? Like, a hardback life is real nice, real nice. Mm. Now, if you miss out on the free 2 months, you can also use code Lord of the Flies to get 90% off your first month. Again, all the links are in the show notes.
Okay, so we're here, you know, it's back to school. We thought this will be a great kind of conversation because some of the school reading lists are so set in stone that there's no consideration of like, we will always read Catcher in the Rye. We will never not consider not reading Catcher in the Rye. And that's just how we're going to do until it all collapses, probably here in the next few years. So just like buckle up for that. We thought, because we are almost some of the highest paid podcasters in the game, we were like, what if we reconsidered some of these reading lists? So that's what our conversation is going to be here. We're going to talk about those that we like and the ones that we don't like. Before we do that, though, I did kind of want to lay a baseline of like, for all of us, what was a one book that we read in school from one of these reading lists? Like, it doesn't have to be one of these books that we're going to talk about today, but just a book that was assigned that you had an incredible experience with, or it could be like a terrible experience with. Jamie, like, I know you didn't read a lot before podcasting.
Listen, Cliff Notes, who built that company on her back? That would be me.
So what was a bad, like, Cliff's Notes experience, if you want to go that direction?
Thank you so much for asking. It is the Scarlet Letter. For somebody who was deeply entrenched in evangelical purity culture at the time, but also being like, oh, what's Hester? Oh, like, that's illicit. We love it. It was like probably my introduction to you. I really like a little smut. Like, even though there's not a lot of open door, Nathaniel Hawthorne didn't write a lot of open door, but I liked A Hidden Husband. I liked her baby named Pearl. I did get the symbolism of all that. And and also her just being like, I'm not going to name the father. You figure it out. I don't know. I liked all the salaciousness of that compared to the other things we were reading, which I found to be quite boring. Last of the Mohicans, no offense. I was like, okay, so there's no more? Is that what happened? Okay.
Yep.
Again, I didn't read it. I just skimmed it.
Okay, Aaron, what's an example, good or bad, for you?
You can F right off with Of Mice and Men. I freaking hate this book. It is the meanest book that has ever happened. I cannot believe the ending of this book. I remember viscerally throwing this book across Mrs. Coleman's classroom because I was like, I cannot believe that we're doing this. This is what we're doing. It's awful.
It's so short, though. It's so nice because it's like 100 pages.
I'm supposed to be okay with this? I'm supposed to live my life after this? Absolutely not.
That's 100% true. I didn't see the sadness coming.
No.
I was like, this is kind of fun and short and I like this. And wait, what? Like, it's such a devastating.
And then it just like comes at you like a 2x4?
Yeah.
I've never been so angry in my whole life.
Yeah, that's a dark one. That's a really tough one.
But it's an important lesson to learn in the ninth grade.
Is it?
Yeah.
No, probably not.
I think in a crime-fighting duo, are you the smart one or the muscle? And if you're the muscle, you're probably going to get taken advantage of.
You need
of.
To pay attention. You need to be aware of your surroundings. Yeah. Keep your head on pinky? A swivel.
Are you the brain? And if you're pinky, watch out.
Watch out. That's exactly right.
My example, this is actually a really good one. This was my freshman year at Samford University. I took Chris Mitras's class. I don't know what the name of it, but it was about literature. But what he did, he assigned us The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. And I was like, boring. I've read this. Everyone's read this. But he taught it as like, this is the poem everyone gets wrong. Everyone misinterprets it. Here's the actual interpretation. This is a guy talking about taking the road less traveled. He doesn't actually take the road less traveled. He takes the one that's normally traveled. Actually, they're both normally traveled, but he just, in years after the seminal event, he talks about how he took the road less traveled and how it made him who he is. And it's about American exceptionalism and about how American culture, it's instructive to American culture and how we like to talk about how we do the difficult thing and we're self-made, but often that's not the case. That's just an identity we take on. And it was like, listening to him teach this, I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, first of all, how did you get to that interpretation? Why is it so true now that I'm actually reading it? And how do you do this? And just the example of interpretation and how you can take it like it's what, four stanzas? And like he drew all this out of it that no one else in my life had ever talked about. Hmm. And I was like, this is incredible. So that was an example of like a real classic bedrock American poem that got reinterpreted
and
for
so
me.
So many like, people wow. use that as like their yearbook quote.
Yeah. I have taken the road less traveled.
And it's like, dog, you're showing yourself as a liar.
Also,
you know?
You're an accountant at this reunion. So I don't know that you did take the road less traveled.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe you did. I haven't looked at your LinkedIn, but that's cool. Okay, that's our personal baseline on school reading list curriculums that went poorly or well. Let's go ahead and we're going to talk about the ones we want to keep on the reading list, and we're going to talk about ones we want to remove from the reading list. So, Aaron, do you want to start us off with what you want to keep?
Yeah, I do. This is another John Steinbeck, even though I hate Of Mice and Men, and this is called The Pearl. This is a short story. It was originally a short story, and then it became a novella. It was written in 1945, and it's sort of like this parable. I'm pretty sure we read the novella. So the summary is that Kino is a pearl fisherman. He lives in Baja California, sir, and his baby gets stung by a scorpion. And when he and his wife try to take the baby to the doctor, they don't have enough money and also racism. So the doctor won't like treat the baby. And so he's like, I gotta go pearl hunt diving and find like a pearl so I can pay for treatment for my baby so my baby doesn't die of scorpion bite or sting. I don't know. What do scorpions do? Do
they sting? I think they sting. They okay. definitely sting.
I'm a Scorpio, so I do know they sting.
Okay. Well, so they
I'm
sting.
Not a Scorpio. I just use my common sense.
Don't act like you're better than me, Sagittarius. Don't act like you're better than me.
So he goes diving and he finds something called the Pearl of the World. It's like a big pearl. And so he's like, oh my gosh, all my problems are going to go away. Isn't that amazing? And which is crazy because they totally get worse. And so like all the villagers are pissed that Kino found the pearl and they didn't. They want the pearl. He tries to sell the pearl, but all the pearl dealer people are like, oh no, we're working together behind the scenes to keep the pearl value down. So you like, you think you're going to get like a lot of money for this, but we're only going to give you a little bit. And so like people try to steal it. He's attacked. His house gets destroyed. These other villagers are like hunting him to find the pearl because they want the pearl. And so he and his wife and his kid, who by the way, is still suffering from scorpion sting, they like, they have to leave town. And when they're out of town, something like the trackers are tracking them. They're trying to find the pearl, whatever. And they kill the kid on accident.
What?
Yeah. And anyway, then Kino ends up throwing the pearl back into the ocean because it obviously gave him all of these freaking problems. But it was like, I have a distinct memory of reading this. Like there's, I mean, I have a distinct memory of like some of the quotes because I was just like, this is crazy. It was like such a good parable about greed and like how an, like, an obsession of something can change the course of your life. There's like a line in it that was, that talks about how like pearls are accidents and finding one was luck, a little pat on the back by God. Hmm. And about, and then it just like completely ruined this dude's life. And it was, it's just, it's so good. And it's short. And the writing is truly, I think it's like the second best thing that he wrote.
Okay. Mm. Just to recap.
Yeah.
So Of Mice and Men, bad because sad.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Baby killed, not sad.
Accidentally killed.
Accidentally killed.
Still not sad?
I mean,
still
yes, it's sad? Obviously very sad. I'm not saying we shouldn't read sad things. I'm saying maybe like your friend who you've been like chumming around with on the road shouldn't be the guy that kills you out of like a mercy kill. Mm-hmm. And stuff happens sometimes and it sucks. Fair. And I think mm-hmm. I think there's just I love this idea that like the pearl was so lucky and it was like meant as a blessing and they saw it as a blessing and it ended up like completely destroying their lives. That's beautiful literarily.
Well, I do. Okay. I like. Okay. I'm trying to think of this. I've got a kid graduating.
Yeah.
I've got a daughter coming into high school, and you're constantly thinking, how do we prepare these brains mm-hmm. to like be a person in the world? And I like the idea of the story being like the thing you think will fix all your problems often can create its own set of problems or make everything worse. That Pandora's box kind of thing.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Old Man and the Sea a little bit.
Yeah, you know? A little bit.
You get this incredible thing and everyone else tries to take it from you mm-hmm. And it creates a lot of issue. Or it kind of reminded me of No Country for Old Men, listening to you describe
it. A little bit.
You know?
Yeah.
I just didn't know scorpions were on beaches. I that's a new fear.
There was a scorpion at my camp, my kids' camp. So I'm used to that.
I don't know. Like there's like, so the way it happens is like the baby is like in a crib, but like, uh-huh. it's like a crate that's hanging on a rope or something.
Okay.
Like kind of like a swing thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's a scorpion on the rope and he like tries to hit it off. But when he hits it off, he hits it into the crib, which is like, hey,
that's a pretty big fumble.
Probably could have done a little bit better.
I saw a TikTok where we had a bear in Birmingham in a shopping center.
What?
And I was like, where'd this bear come from? Like, we're not even, I mean, it's Appalachia barely. You know, like, where's this bear?
It's Appalachia. Been? It's Appalachia.
The foothills.
I know, but like, where's that bear living? Like, where's that bear?
Where, like, is it up in Greystone?
Why are
like,
you
in
now
the backyard?
At this Hobby Lobby? Mm. Like, why are you now at this Hobby Lobby? Like, I get it, it's 40% off, but it's always 40% off.
The bigger question is, why is the bear here, right? What's pushed
the
bear out?
I don't like that. I don't like that. I will say, I did, because I love a 1-star review, and this one is under classics. And Susanna, who added to her name, censored by Goodreads, so there seems like there's some beef there. She said, avoid if you loathe allegory and an overload of symbolism. But that feels like everything that we read in English class.
Yeah, right? That's like part
that's
of
the that's point.
Part of, yeah, that's the point of it.
So censored by Goodreads, my
unreal. Okay, Jamie, what is something you'd like to keep?
Okay, so I have talked about this before, that in my senior year, in our last semester, we were required in AP English to do a full term paper, right? The whole, the note cards, the outline, the conclusion, whatever. Anyway, and so we had to pick a book, and I picked off the list Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, written in 1947, because I thought it was about a man who was invisible, like had the superpower of invisibility.
I mean, that's context clues. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that is how far my symbolism went. And so I decided, since I'd already gotten into college and I had a full scholarship, I just would not turn in that project. And so I did end my perfect 4.0, dropped to a 3.8 because I failed. I got a C in English. And Miss Vest, I apologize to her. She was the worst, but I do apologize to her because I later did read Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, and it is a stunner. It's a stunner. So it was his first novel and the only one published in his lifetime.
Oh.
It was, it's truly like, it's considered one of the best works of the 20th century. He was the first Black person to win the National Book Award for this book in the 50s. And so we have an unnamed narrator, the Invisible Man, who graduates from high school. And he gives this great speech And then all the whites in the neighborhood are like, well, you have to be in the battle royale, and we're going to make black teenagers fight each other for our entertainment. Right. And which is very uncomfortable, but he does get the scholarship. And then he gets to go to a prestigious black college. He thinks he's on his way. Unfortunately, he was chauffeuring a wealthy donor to this college, and things went awry. And so they sent him away from this college with a stack of recommendation letters that, unbeknownst to him, all say, don't hire this guy and don't let this guy. So it's just him kind of moving through his life. It's first person narrative, which I really love in this book, because you watch the way he speaks change over his life from the beginning of the book. I loved that. I thought that was such a clever way to show how we mature. But obviously, the invisibility nature of it's obviously the lessons are, hey, it doesn't matter if you're in a space, because he moves to Harlem. He joins this group called the Brotherhood. He thinks he now has finally a family and recognition of who he is and his values. And of course, that turns that goes bad, too, because of some politics and betrayal and race riots and things like that. And then he finally is like, he kind of realizes the invisible nature of who he is. It's not that people can't see him, despite little baby Jamie thinking that that would be what it was. It was that they are not seeing him as a complete human being. And what's been so helpful in reading that now, and why I think it's really important to keep reading this book, one, to have diversity in your authors, obviously. But also what I love about this is everybody in high school has a component of their life that either is present already while they're reading this or will later, that's their own invisibility of the thing that is going to make people make assumptions about them, whether it is a disability, whether for me, it was being fat. People just assumed everything about me because I was fat. And so it was like people couldn't see me. And it's been weird in seasons of my life where I've weighed less or weighed more, that 100% pivots the way that I'm seen and addressed and consumed, or my value of my words, my takes. Because often on the internet, if someone doesn't like my take, their initial response is, well, you're fat, what would you know? And it was like, don't get me started. And like Knox said, I ruined someone's life on Threads.
That's why she's going off on Threads now.
That's exactly, you know? Right.
Because she read Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
I know. But even in our own work, like it sometimes, you know, there's an element of like, even to this day, when I say to people, I'm a podcaster, they're like, oh my God, that's so cute. Like, did you do another job? Like, did you ever have a real job? And so there's small elements of our lives and large elements of our lives that, you know, our identity. I think it's a beautiful exploration of identity and that it's universal. Like, obviously, it depends on your political identity. It's your expectations of your family. It could be your peers. Obviously, it's a look into American history, which I love when we can learn while we read a really great piece of fiction, right? Talking about the Great Migration and the Harlem in the 30s. And then, of course, you know, there's so much symbolism in it, even that I can get as someone who does not clock symbolism on the regular in terms of the briefcase and electricity. If you've read it, you know. And so I really love it. And it combines a lot of things that I love, which are coming of age, and there's some satire in it. And I think it's a hard book. It is over 500 pages. It's a long book. And I think that's can be difficult to teach because you're just going to have people who are like, is this a poem or no? No, more than four stanzas? Okay. I think that can be challenging, but what a beautiful book. So apologies to Mrs. Vest. I wish I had read. Would have 17-year-old Jamie been able to read this with discerning eyes? No, not at all. Mm. She just still would have been mad that, what if he had been invisible? What if there's a sequel where he actually does have that superpower?
Because what was the assignment originally?
So it was like everyone had to read a classic and do a full term paper on it, like a 10.
Oh, just write a paper on the classic.
How dare you? So, don't say it like that.
He said, just write a paper.
You have to write a paper. The hardest thing that I've ever done. Your girl was scored a 5 on the AP calculus exam. She failed AP English. Come on.
I wanted to ask, did you try to read it? Or were you just like, I'm not doing this?
No, I did. I started.
You did, and you were just like, not for me.
And then I was like, immediately, I was like,
I get that.
You know what? I don't even have to do this.
Was it like, was it the fact that he wasn't invisible that you were like, I think I'm out now?
No, the invisibility being symbolic? No.
You're like, absolutely I'm 100 not. Pages okay. in, and this guy hasn't perved out on watching people get undressed. What's happening here?
I mean, there's on? So many Ridiculous. Opportunities that you could use this for your good. Yeah. You could F up some white supremacists if you were actually invisible. Like, That's you true. Could really ruin their lives, you know?
Could do okay. a lot of things.
So the Invisible Man 2, it's Thank you. It's like Django, but he's invisible.
You know, the comedy, too, is when you Google Invisible Man, it is the Elizabeth Moss movie that, to be honest, I really loved. And it's also
That's a good
based
movie.
On a book. And it's a great movie. And it's based on, but I'm always like, God, even after all this, Elizabeth Moss is getting SEO'd to the top instead of this black man's classic novel. Like, what a tough situation.
Aaron, I'm not even going to ask if you've watched it, but there's a scene where she's her husband's an invisible man, and he's doing, like, shady stuff.
Yeah. Like, what? Like, what is he doing?
I don't know if he's doing pervy stuff as much as it's, like, tech Silicon Valley stuff.
Wait,
you know?
He's invisible?
Well, he's, like, a suit that he can put on what? To make himself invisible. But she's trying to, like, talk about it, because that's the biggest issue in, like, these movies where someone's doing something bad. She's like, just tell someone. Just, yeah. like, see you something, just, say something.
Yeah, you
and she's at dinner trying to tell, I don't know if it's, like, a friend or sister-in-law, and you see the knife come up from the table, and then it slits her friend's throat, and then it puts the knife yeah. in Elizabeth Moss's hand, and everyone starts screaming. It's a pretty good scene. It's not as good as the book, Jamie.
That's crazy.
It seems like,
no,
it
and
seems,
it's tough, too, because, like, that movie is based on an H.G. Wells book. So, like, it's, you know, it's a classic as well. So,
yeah.
No matter. Anyway,
that's a good one, though. That's a good one to keep in. For the one I want to keep in, I think, you know, I could make a case. I think I've talked too much about Their Eyes Were Watching God. So I didn't want to say that because I've talked too much about it. But I do think that's one I want to see in. And plus, when I was preparing for this episode, I didn't even realize, like, how Their Eyes Were Watching God came to be. I think it came out and it sold like 8,000 copies. And then this literary critic was like, this doesn't go hard enough at white people.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I was like, what? And it was kind of like, it needs to be more angry at white people, which it's a great book. Not because I'm like, it's not mad at white people. It's a great book because it's about this woman's life and just like trying to figure it out for herself. So it kind of dies out. And then Alice Walker, goes looking for Zora Neale Hurston's, grave, and it's unmarked. And it's like this weedy cemetery. So she pays for a headstone, and then writes an essay about In Search of Zora Neale Hurston. And the book kind of kicks back up into prominence that people are like, hey, I think this kind of is a good book. So I'm not making the case for Their Eyes Were Watching God. It makes its own case. But the one I did want to talk about was, Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Ugh.
And I want to include it. Obviously, Frankenstein, iconic monster. But in terms of the teaching aspect of like how you can deliver this to kids, I think, you know, the whole origin story, which I'm sure a lot of people are aware of, is I think it's 1816. It's Mary Shelley, her Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, and some other guy named John.
Nobody remembers.
Like, I know. I even looked up his name. I was like, I need to shout this guy out, but I don't even know. He might have bad tweets though, so I don't want to shout him too much. But they were, I think they were bored, and they were just like, let's do a little competition. As I'm explaining this, I'm like, this is Jamie's hell, probably.
Yeah.
Hey, we're super bored. Let's all write a story and then read
a short
it to
story.
Like, truly, could we like play spades? What are we doing?
Wasn't it like the weather was bad, right? Like, wasn't
yes.
it? Yeah, the weather.
Yeah.
No. It was like the volcano in Iceland.
Oh, was this the year the volcano erupted?
I think it is. And so the ash was all up in the atmosphere and they couldn't go outside. And so they had to stay. I'm almost positive.
I could
be wrong about that.
I'm going to
raw dog that. I'm not even going to Google it.
Just let it be true.
Yeah.
Even if it's not, don't correct us. That's a cooler story. But so she, they all come up with stories. She comes up with Frankenstein, like a first draft of one. And we're like, that's kind of crazy. She's 18 years old when she does that. And I think when she's 20, she publishes it anonymously. And then, you know, it gets a little bit more run a little bit later. But I love the aspect of like, hey, this is an 18-year-old. And this is what she came up with. Isn't this a cool idea? Like, you guys are capable of doing this stuff, even though your generation's attention span is probably just rotten to the core. So, like, there's no chance you could do something like this. But if you let yourself try, like, I think that's a great angle to be able to teach. But I also think a reinterpretation of the creature, because when you do engage with the story, you realize it's not the classic, you know, bolt through the head, green-faced monster. Like, the monster's kind of incredibly articulate, really thoughtful. And I think that the central problem of the story is like, I was made by someone and then that person left. And I think this is a theme you see in Prometheus of like, what do you do when the person who created you like doesn't care for you anymore or is indifferent or ambivalent? And I think in a time of crumbling bureaucracies and institutions and even reinterpretations of religion, I think it's such a powerful conversation to be able to have. Like, what do we do when we're not sure what our purpose is or like what the interpretation of what's been created is supposed to be. And I think that's a really powerful thing to give kids that is dressed in like, this is kind of a boring story probably, but A, we had our monster all wrong, and B, we had the whole point of the story all wrong. So I'd really love an idea of keeping that on curriculum. How does that strike you guys?
I love that because then you can roll in the TV cart. You can mm-hmm. watch a little Frederick Frankenstein mm-hmm. starring yep. Gene Wilder, the young Frankenstein. I love so much because for me, I was always like, this is scary. This is sad. Even like watching Guillermo del Toro's last year mm-hmm. as an adaptation. But I think Young Frankenstein is really a brilliant film and it hints at so many of those things that you're talking about, too, of being like, how do you reconcile? How do you go no contact with someone that brought you life? I mean, literally, that's a whole conversation we can have in so many segments of life.
Well, it's almost like it's almost the same thing as the pearl. It's like the thing that you've worked for, the thing that you've created. If you don't like it can also turn on you, and it can turn on you because of your own actions, and it can turn on you because of an accident. And it's just, I think it's like there's so much to say about fate and destiny and like what choices you have in your life and how those choices impact where your life and other people's lives go. I like the text is so freaking rich and I I'm for this. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. I do think a lot of times in taught stories, it's not that the richer the text, the better experience, but the more, unfortunately, this is true for all of us, the more you allow something to be reinterpreted through their own lens, your own lens, and you can apply your conversation to it. I feel like it engages people more than just like, it's a big whale and a guy's got like a hard on for it. What is this about? You
know
what
I mean? Tell me more, 17-year-old. I
know. And it's also the hat tip to a woman wrote something other than a Regency romance, you know, or, I mean, I do love a good gothic horror in, Jane Eyre. But
just a badass gothic horror in the haze of a volcanic eruption, allegedly.
Yeah. I mean,
that's pretty awesome.
No, I love it. I'm all into that.
Freaking rules.
Okay, let's talk about fails, books we want removed forever and ever from the curriculum school reading list. Erin, what do you have?
I'll tell you who I never want to see on a required reading list author situation, and that is William Sidney Porter, a.k.a. O. Effing Henry. I freaking hate that guy. The Gift of the Magi is the stupidest thing I have ever read in my whole life. What am I supposed to... Okay, first of all, it's like a fourth grade reading level, which is great for the fourth graders, not great for the eighth graders. And then you're telling me, like, it's just, he's so like, he's the Quentin Tarantino of short story authors, because he's just like looking in the mirror and he's like, oh my gosh, yes, like I'm so clever.
No, for the audio, Aaron's making a jerk off motion. And Quentin Tarantino only does that for feet, okay? So you watch it.
No, but he's just like, Quentin Tarantino's like, it's like he's like typing and looking in the mirror and being like, this is so good. Like, I'm
you getting this?
So
oh,
good.
This is rich.
Oh my gosh.
You're
yeah.
right.
That's exactly who O. Henry is. Like, he's just like, I'm so clever and I'm going to just like do a little twisty around on you. And then we're going to talk about the power of love. Shut up. I don't care. It's stupid. It's boring. And I never want to read it again. It's sentimental slop.
I've never read this.
Read The Gift of the Magi? Can I explain it to you? Okay.
Of course.
So a girl who has like really long hair, and that's her whole personality, is that she has really long hair. And she's like, oh my gosh, I love my husband so much. And the only thing that he has in his whole life is his pocket watch. And these are like, his pocket watch is like his prized possession. And my long hair is my prized possession. And so she's like, I want to do something nice for my husband. So she goes and she cuts her hair for a wig lady. And the wig lady is like, all right, here's $20. Oh, by the way, she only has like a dollar $1.78 or something. And she's like, I got to get my husband something because he's such a great person. And so she gives her money. And so now she goes and she's like, I'm going to get a strap, like a leather strap. First of all, who's buying a leather strap for $20 in the like 1800s? It's stupid.
It's nice quality.
I don't think it's going to be $20. You can get a house for $20 at that
point. What's the strap for?
Like his watch, so he can wear his watch or whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
Not just like a leather, like a ball gag or something.
Like she's going to spank him with it? Because somebody's no. back in. Yeah.
Oh, Henry, indeed.
So she buys the watch strap and she comes home and she's like, oh my gosh, I have a gift for you. And he's like, that's so crazy. I have a gift for you. Wait, what did you do to your hair? And she's like, well, I sold it so I could buy you this watch strap. And then do you know what he does? He's like, well, here's your present. And it's all these like beautiful jewel encrusted combs that she can't even freaking use because guess what she did? She cut her MRFing hair. And you know how he got those? You know how he got those combs? He sold his GD pocket watch. So now they have a leather strap and combs they can't use, but they love each other. And that's the moral of the story.
Okay.
Yeah, but isn't the moral of the story too, like, isn't it about like you can be making a decision that you think is the right one and then it's not the right one?
But
like the consequences of our choices.
But nobody, it's not even that deep. It's like, oh no, we gave sacrificial gifts to each other and that means we love each other. That's literally like there is no deeper interpretation of this. It's literally that. But yes, you're right.
But
it could have been
a twist.
Cool.
I do love a twist.
The worst twist I've ever read in my life. It's like M. Night Shyamalan.
As you explain it, that kind of sounds sick. To be honest with you, I like it a lot.
No, not,
but it feels like it's more about, isn't the economy terrible? And isn't capitalism, I love capitalism. Listen, personally because I benefited from it, but it sucks when you're getting gifts, I guess.
You know? Aaron, how mad are you that people on the regular on O. Henry's grave leave 60 pennies because of the gift of the Magi?
That's so boring. So like,
why do they leave 60 pennies?
Because part of the, like, she has like $1.78 or whatever, and like 60 cents of it is pennies. And it's like, the book starts out with like $1.78. That's all she had. And 60 cents of it was pennies. And it's like, okay.
But O. Henry is a badass name.
That's not even his real name.
No, I know, but it's a great pen name.
I feel like y'all are baiting me and I'm mad about it.
The only O. Henry I'd heard about are the bars. Like the...
Oh, the coffee shop in Birmingham?
Yeah, I guess it's the coffee shop bar. So this is news to me. Yeah,
I got yelled at O. Henry's once.
Aaron and I met for the first time.
You always get yelled at in restaurant situations.
Hey, listen, Aaron and I met for the first time in an O. Henry's.
That's right, we did. Oh my gosh.
So that can be your renewed
memory. That's the redemption
story.
Yeah. Anyway, F. O. Henry, F. the gift of the Magi.
That's amazing.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something. But this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery. But we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Jamie, what's your pick? Something you want to leave
off? Okay, so I've not picked one specific work, but I have picked all the works of another William. And that's Shakespeare. We don't need it.
You're baiting.
Hear me out. I know this is difficult for a
this
theater
is
and
master
an English
Jamie
major.
Baiting
this
right
is,
now.
This is rage
out.
Bait.
Hear me out. Listen, when you're reading, like obviously I became a lifelong reader after high school. But if I could have skipped all the Shakespeare I was made. Don't interrupt me yet.
No, I have a question.
Put your hand down.
Can you be a lifelong reader after high school? Or does it have to be lifelong?
Hey, I've lived 32 years after high school. I've lived a long time. But here's the thing. First of all, I don't think that Shakespeare, first of all, can we be honest? These are better performed, not read as a pretend novel. Okay. Also, can we pick any language that's 400 years closer to where we literally are? Like, I don't need to have a translator for this whole thing. And I know, oh, it makes me a better person if I can think about the word. Blah, blah, blah. It doesn't. It doesn't. I like Hamnet because they don't give into that language. You know, that's a better book and a better movie because of that. Listen here, and I'll trade you out. We don't need Macbeth because we have the Hunger Games. Okay. Same
Jamie,
concept.
Not
same
even.
Concept. We don't need Othello because we have Invisible Man. See? Look, we don't need that. We don't need... Listen, Count of Monte Cristo, so much better than Hamlet. Let's just read that instead.
What are you talking
okay?
about?
Dog, where do you think we got some of these? Where do you think they got inspiration from?
Again, but better written, better to understand, easier for a student to go, you know what? I love this. Instead of reading Shakespeare and going, so... This is Romeo and Juliet's the best thing I'm ever going to read. No, it's not the best thing you're ever going to read. It's not even the best Shakespeare you're going to read. But somehow we always have to read Romeo and Juliet. Okay. Obviously we have there are even better books that are like, I mean, like The Joylet Club, like The Kite Runner. These are all better books by real people who we can look to who have interesting stories like Zora Neale Hurston.
I feel like the American hostage in a video where the terrorist is doing a diatribe right now, and I just have to sit here and I just have to listen.
Listen, the fact
and
that
that's
I'm
my
trying
job.
To read, look, I have enjoyed Shakespeare when I've watched it. Like I went to the, listen, I was sat in the Globe Theater. I watched Othello and loved it. Loved it. I truly mean that. Like I loved it, but to suggest that we're asking 15-year-olds to read Shakespeare and understand it, comprehend it, like embrace it. I do think that happens to the two of you and then four other nerds. And then the rest of us are like, is this good? I mean, I guess it has to be. I feel like the most overrated classics writer is William Shakespeare.
This isn't
is that even his name.
This
even
is the, an even insane that is his name. Take.
Also, we're American. Could we read some American authors?
We read so many American authors.
We don't. We read so many British authors.
And that's okay, but we do read American authors.
We do.
I didn't know J.D. Vance was here making the case
oh
for more.
Oh, my God. I didn't know this was MAGA. Again, I just think we could read updated works that are better at trying to explain ambition or racism or
it's a singular experience as a 11th grader or a 10th grader sitting reading All's Well That Ends Well or whatever reading and like you the moment you get it
right.
It's like you level up in your reading, you understand things in a different way.
Listen, she loves Richard II, right? And she tricked me into going to London, hear me out, she tricked me into going to London because Jonathan Bailey was going to be starring in it. Listen, it was stunning, it was a beautiful play. I tried to read it on the way on the plane and I was like, F this, I want to watch The Martian. This is ridiculous. And The Martian is a better story that I can access. But when I saw the play, I was like, this is amazing. So I do think it is a valuable piece of text, but I just think it's meant to be performed. Please stop making me try to read plays in my English class. Like, I'd rather read short stories than read plays, you know?
I mean, the point you're making is... The value or in value of friction when trying
Thank
to
you.
Contemplate something. And I understand what you're saying because it's why college and high school classes now are being like, read this chapter. We can't possibly ask you to read the book, but just read this chapter. And while it's a viable method of teaching and a realistic method of teaching, something is lost in the margins there. And I think when you stop teaching or reading Shakespeare, it's functional, but I think something is lost when we stop asking people to try to understand.
Listen, and I think there are plenty of other books that can maximize your educational value for a greater number of students. And I think that they can be just as challenging. They can teach those same lessons. They can demonstrate those same concepts in an English class without having to really fight through. And I just think it doesn't honor the greatest number of students in a classroom. So that's why Shakespeare's gone.
I would also say that the experience of reading a play, like reading it as literature, as opposed to seeing it performed, is a different like discipline for your brain than reading a short story, a novel, an essay, a poem, whatever. I think it like there is an imaginative thing that I think that happens in your brain where you're putting yourself into these places even more so than you would be in a novel or something like that. I think there's it's like tickles a different part of your brain and it activates
tickle,
that.
I think tickle's doing a lot of work, but I definitely think you're right. But I think I have a really nice house and pretty hair and I don't ever need to read a play. But you know what I mean? So
but those you don't need to read it.
No.
But I think especially thinking in terms of
I know it's hard for the theater and English major to push past that. But I get that. But
no, I get that you're concerned trolling Shakespeare, but I do think what we're asking by this logic eventually will be like, all we need is Family Circus, Peanuts, and Kathy.
Again,
and
that's not what I said. You know what I mean? I don't equate the Kite Runner to mediocre literature. I don't equate the Joy Luck Club to mediocre literature. And to suggest so just shows a bias for Shakespeare that I get it. You're in love with them. That's fine.
But didn't you read The Crucible?
No.
You didn't?
No, I read The Scarlet Letter. I don't need both. I got the lady. I don't need the man.
Nobody needs both, but I think...
Again, I know. But I'm just saying, there are plenty of great works. I just don't think we have to be going back to the same trough.
Sure. I as someone who doesn't like to read anything beyond the dialogue, I get that Shakespeare is challenging.
Which, to be fair, should be her sweet spot.
Yeah.
You should love this.
Yeah, because it's dialogue heavy. It really is.
Dialogue in a language that is not even accessible to me. And as a 16-year-old, it's not even accessible to me. And I'm not saying that you can't challenge a 16-year-old, that there was no suggestion of that in this discussion. And I get that that's the easy way out of the argument of like, but we must challenge the children.
No,
we
I think
challenge
but
them with other works. We can challenge them with
we
poetry.
Can, but
we
I think
can challenge them with short stories. With
maximizing the ease of reading and maximizing the immediacy of interpretation and relevancy, that is a slippery slope of like, well, let's just like, we want to maximize returns and we want to maximize understanding. So let's just make it more modern. Let's just cater more to ourselves and the immediacy of America and the 21st century. And I think that starts to, you start to lose a lot of great literature and great minds.
And listen, note for the audio, Erin is pulling down her hat to cover her eyes because she's so upset with me. A hat that does say Dramini Specialist.
Oh, we contain so multitudes.
Again, that's what I'm saying is we can contain multitudes. I just think that if you are trying to reach the greatest number of readers in high school, I just think Shakespeare is not accomplishing that goal.
But
at
I
all.
Think that's the point of reading, or one of the points of reading in high school, is to expose you to things that you're never going to read later on.
That's Master Jamie Bate, though. So
mm-hmm. I know.
Well done.
Exquisitely. Listen, it's not. It is not just clickbait. I mean, I obviously saw the win on the side of it, but it's also like I do really believe that. I think there are even better plays that we could be reading if we are going to keep a play that's complex.
What?
I don't know. What did The Death of a Salesman? I don't know.
Oh my God, Jamie, you would hate The Death of a Salesman.
I hate plays as a general rule, but I'm saying like if at least make it in this century, even I'll give you the last century. I'll give you the 1800s.
But things were happening in Shakespeare's time that are irrelevant and are not like they're not the same thing that was happening in the 1800s. And so you're like, you're getting different vibes. You're getting different cultural context.
I know. I know.
No, I love that tone is not condescending at all. And we'll keep going. We'll keep going. We'll keep going. The book I want to remove. I'm surprised. I did three because I was like, I'm worried some of these might go. So I'm going through these and I'm gonna say, you know what I'm gonna say?
What will hurt Jamie the most? Choose that one.
Again, I don't think any of these. Someone who did not read. Someone who has a sociology women's studies degree. Go ahead.
I'll be excited to hear if I'll give you my three and tell me if you disagree with any of these, their inclusion. Okay. The first, the biggest layup, Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
I don't think
Gone.
You need it.
Out.
I don't. Yeah.
Bye.
So we don't really have to go over that. Bye. The maybe a little bit controversial, but I feel like it's been here too long. Great Gatsby.
Yes.
I agree.
I don't think we need
it. I have
it
in my also rans.
Yeah. Okay. It's in my also rans.
So there.
Yeah.
I think I didn't know how. Like it got here because it's always so interesting how a book becomes a canonical like school reading list. And I read it was, you know, when Fitzgerald was still alive or before he died, like it sold 25,000 copies, but it wasn't a big deal. And then he died obviously in obscurity. And And then at some, the count, I'm just reading this from like Wikipedia, the Council on War Books in Wartime shipped 155,000 free armed service edition to troops overseas during World War II. And then by 1961, it was being printed specifically for school curriculum reading lists. Like, it wasn't like there's a big demand. People want to know what this Gatsby guy's doing. It's just like schools want this. So now we are one-to-one just printing it for schools to sell and read for students. And I'm like, that's such a,
like a good reason.
No.
Yeah. It skipped over like, man, this is so such a compelling story that we got. Now, I think there is a big relevance to Gatsby and curriculums because the idea of like ambition and of built like what you want, kind of like in The Pearl, the thing you want may be the thing that undoes you. But I think it's more of a middle-aged novel than it is like a coming of age kind of novel. So that would be my reason to get rid of it. The one that I'm going to officially pick is Lord of the Flies, William Golding. Not because it's not good. I think it's a really good book. I think it's taught as like, this is what's up and this is how it would be. And I know coming out of World War II, it's like, well, we kind of just witnessed it. So this probably tracks. But there in 1965, this actually happened. And we saw, or I don't know if it was 1965 or later, this actually happened to a group of boarding students. It didn't fall apart. They worked really well together. They got saved. Everything was chill and everything was cool.
Saved as in they got rescued or they know Jesus now?
No, they got rescued. They got rescued. Okay. Yeah, maybe like the tide Jesus took them out. They got lost for a hot minute. But I think instead of teaching like the second the teachers go away, you guys are probably going to try to kill each other. I think a more hopeful message would be like, you don't have to teach a more hopeful lesson with Lord of the Flies. I think it's a great book, but I think in terms of school reading lists, I feel like it's giving a different message and almost one that's like,
it's inevitable.
Yeah, like assumptively nihilistic. And I don't know that that's actually the case necessarily for kids. Now, for adults, that's a different story. But I think we can do, if it's taken up a spot, I think we can do something better with, you know?
Mm. Yeah, because like the Andes plane crash where the kids all in the 70s, there's a movie called
We're Alive or whatever.
Yeah, the Society of the Snow came out a couple few years ago. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it made me, I was like, I want to read everything about these. And when you read about, when you see their story, you're like, oh yeah, they can be like, kids can work together. Like they can learn who has strengths, who has weaknesses. How can we accommodate everybody and everybody be a part? So yeah.
So I'm going to remove that and put something cooler in its place. So
listen, I have my also rans. I did include, I feel like one, I don't know. I don't feel like you'll be as passionate about these exits, but Beowulf, I don't need that anymore. Mm. And Canterbury Tales, don't need that.
I agree. It's unfinished.
It's
unfinished.
And then books about boys. I get it. Like I get Huckleberry Finn and Treasure Island and all of that. I don't need any more of that. I'm good. Now, I don't think that's true if you have boys in your class. So I'm talking about at my all girls school that I'm going to run. Yeah.
Where we don't read Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Listen, if y'all are ready, again, this is part one of a duology. If you think they're mad now, just wait until next week's episode.
Oh, I'm not mad. I'm sad for you.
Right.
I'm sad that you're saying this in public.
I'm mad. I'm angry.
Listen, everybody who's not an English teacher, bring your support to me. Let them know that you agree with me.
Yes, exactly. Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of Shelf Respect.
Okay, don't forget, everything we talked about is in the show notes, and we would love to see you talk about it too. You can head to Threads. We're on there as Read with Shelf Respect. We also are on Instagram, Read with Shelf Respect. The links are in the show notes. And then if you're a hardback, you can have this whole conversation on Patreon at patreon.com/shelfrespect. And if you're a freebie and want to become a hardback, again, the codes and the links are in the show notes.
Ask your pointed questions, declare your intentions, start a disrespectful fight with Jamie about her Shakespeare opinion in the comments with one of your enemies just to eventually become lovers.
I'm Jamie Golden. You can find me on the internet at Jamie B. Golden.
I'm Erin Moon. You can find me on the interwebs at Erin H. Moon.
I'm Max McCoy. You can find me on the socials at Max McCoy. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
The end.